Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I am your fearless host, Travis Hornsby, and today we are going to talk about some very popular misconceptions about the PSLF waiver program. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about what I expect will be misconceptions about the IDR waiver once they get around to freaking releasing the FAQ for the thing. And I'm just going to riff a little bit about the state of all of the things that are in flux right now on student loans. It'll be a good summer episode. Maybe you're listening to this while drinking a martini by the pool, or maybe you're just, you know, getting some exercise in, going for a run outside, hanging out at the gym, whatever it is. Hopefully we'll try to entertain you while I inform you with what's going on with student loans right now. The PSLF waiver, I want to talk a little bit about that. I've been for a little while the admin of this group on Facebook called PSLF Physicians, and it's got 14,000 people in it. It's very helpful, I think, about raising awareness around the different things with a PSLF waiver. It's really fascinating to me where this group has reached, market penetration of a fairly large share of the pool of potential eligible physicians of PSLF and the PSLF waiver. And what's interesting is I'll talk to physicians, and a lot of them will have a very clear idea of the PSLF waiver, you know, even ones that hire us and just want to make sure everything looks good, which makes sense, because we do hundreds of these plans a month. And so with something that's really a big deal, like consolidating and trying to make sure that you have the credit that you think you do, and, you know, having expert eyes look over everything, I think it's helpful for people. And then there's obviously still a lot of physicians that don't know about this. People like my wife, who care about medicine, not about money at all. And so she would be completely unaware, I think, of this opportunity unless a colleague shared it with her, because it's just not her focus in life, right? Or it's just not, I should say, it's just not an interest of hers, finances are not. What's interesting is I think about that with physicians, and then I think about other professions, and there's huge lack of awareness for other professions. So there's some really awesome research that came out of University of Virginia. Some economists came out with this research about the PSLF waiver and the pool of potential occupations that could be eligible. And wow, it is a big deal. So like half of all teacher student loan debt could be forgiven, maybe like a quarter of all student loan debt with nurses and some of the social work occupations could be forgiven. I've really underestimated the level of PSLF waiver benefit that could go out to people. And I guess the reason I underestimated it was because when they first came out with the PSLF waiver, they didn't include things like forbearance and deferment. That wasn't talked about yet. They also had not come out with the guidance that they would count the consolidation with the loan with the most number of payment credits on it. So that wasn't public yet. And they also said that this is expected to get people about $5 billion of student loan forgiveness. This is kind of interesting, right? So the press release said that people would get about $5 billion of student loan forgiveness from the PSLF waiver. So this great paper comes out from UVA and says, actually, based off of the PSLF waiver rules, we anticipate that as much as $145 billion could be forgiven because of the PSLF waiver. I think what happened is they came out with these rules and they just added things when they had to make decisions. They erred on the side of generosity, and that just kept ballooning the pool of potentially eligible debt. But I don't know if it's also just like, I mean, it's kind of super misleading that they did it the way they did it, because if you came out and said, hey, we're going to forgive $145 billion of student loan debt, then people would know to apply for it. People would know you need to consolidate. Department of Education, like many government agencies, has a big communications problem. They don't really know what to say to people because they can't make it simple. And perhaps the reason they don't make it simple is because they don't want to cue the opposition that they're doing this. And then that might elicit a lawsuit, or that might elicit political opposition to what they're doing. But one thing that I thought was really fascinating about this paper, if I'm kind of summarizing it accurately, is that under the current state of affairs, higher income, more highly educated people will disproportionately benefit from the PSLF waiver, and inequality in student loan debt is going to increase, not decrease. And why is that? It's because the physician, surgeon with $300,000 of student loans, who makes $300,000 a year, is figuring this out disproportionately more than the single mom who works in city government, who has $20,000 of student loans that are FFELL consolidation loans at Navient. And so that what's happening is people with the larger debt amounts, larger amounts of education and awareness and income and access to professional help like us are figuring this out. And so one of the things in the paper it talks about is that we need to raise awareness for other people to know about the PSLF waiver. And it proposes a lot of different ways that we could raise awareness of this. And actually, it talks about how if everyone took advantage of the PSLF waiver, there would be more equality in student loan debt. It would actually be life-changing for borrowers of color to receive the PSLF waiver. The paper brought up how Black borrowers are disproportionately employed in the public sector. So it would make a huge difference if it was fully implemented. But it's not being fully implemented. And why? It's because this stuff takes a PhD to figure out almost. I mean, it's very complicated. We have meetings, our staff has meetings on it regularly to try to figure out all the nuances so we can get the maximum benefit for our clients. I'm going to be real honest, right? A lot of teachers are going to think twice about booking us at even $395, even, and that's probably going to be even more the case when we raise our prices September 1 to $595 for everyone. Whereas a lot of physicians who maybe have a significantly higher income are more willing to take a chance on us or have just a bigger incentive to take a chance on us if they have $200,000, for example, instead of $50,000 of debt, right? So we decided to take some action around this, then you can actually help us with this. So what I decided to do is, given my experience being one of the admins in this PSLF Facebook group for physicians, one of the things that it says in the Facebook group is that it's only for physicians. And that's understandable because there are unique differences from a physician's training and journey with PSLF compared to someone who's maybe a teacher, right? Or even a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner. It's just a little bit different in terms of residency and fellowship and how often people would put it into residency deferment, which they qualify for, and other groups don't. And so I thought it was super helpful, like, because Facebook, you know, as you know, can be a really toxic place, and Facebook groups can even be a very toxic place where things can get derailed, you know, in a hurry. And then that's not the goal. That's not our goal, right? So what I've found is having it be specific to an occupation and specific to a specific kind of problem, like PSLF, qualifying for PSLF, right? It keeps things relevant. It steers things away from the toxicity sometimes that Facebook kind of can deliver. And it's been really life-changing, I think, for the people that have been a part of it. So we were kind of debating, like, okay, with this price change that we're going to do starting September 1st to make sure we have availability for people that need it due to the rush on our calendars when the IDR waiver FAQ comes out, plus the, you know, nearing end of the PSLF waiver, how can we help people get some level of free help if they can't afford us? So that was the idea behind creating all these PSLF Facebook groups. What you can do now in Facebook is if you type in your occupation, so for example, occupational therapist PSLF, if you type that in on Facebook, you will find our group. If you type in, you know, government employee PSLF, you'll find it. First responder or police PSLF, you'll find our groups. So we've made groups for every major profession that we consult with. There was two that already existed for veterinarians and speech language pathologists. I didn't catch the one that was the veterinarians, so I made that one. So we do have a veterinarian PSLF group, and somebody else does too. And then speech language pathologists, there's already one. So I just decided people could just join that one. Our goal here is not to try to interfere with anything. We just want to create value for you. So if you're going for PSLF, join one of these Facebook groups and please invite all of your colleagues and your friends. Because my goal is people are going to see PSLF something, and more marginally aware people of this PSLF waiver, especially in like communities like nursing, social work, teaching, that are already more like service-oriented fields that make lower salaries and can kind of attract people that have that disproportionately more of like a servant's heart type mindset that aren't really super aware of money stuff in all cases, right? I want to create awareness for those folks, and we want to do it for free. You can help us by joining the group for your occupation if you're going for PSLF, and then going and inviting people to these groups. And I think it's going to help address some of the concerns that were present in this economics paper that said that, you know, the current PSLF waiver take-up is resulting in increased inequality in student loan debt instead of the goal, which is more equality, more access for people that are public servants that are especially from lower income or disproportionately disadvantaged backgrounds, right? So I wanted to talk a little bit about misconceptions around PSLF, the PSLF waiver. So one super common misconception that I'm seeing is people think that you have to have 120 months of credit to get the benefit from it. And that's not true. I'm going to repeat that again. Everybody thinks that the only way you can benefit from the PSLF waiver is to have your full 10 years and be ready to get forgiveness. That is not true. You can get extra credit for forgiveness even if you're short of the 10 years. And that's going to cost people a ton of money, not being aware of that. because one of the cases that we're seeing a lot of right now, I had a friend actually, we were hanging out doing a play date with our one-year-olds, and she had a master's degree in teaching, and she was a teacher before she went back for her master's degree. And she was not at the 10-year mark yet, but what she didn't realize is if she consolidated all the debt, she could get the credit from when she was on her undergrad loans applied to her graduate loans as well. The problem is that can reset your monthly payment to a new number using a new tax return. So the second thing we wanted to make sure is she filing taxes separately the right way? Is her payment low anyway if you reconsolidate and have to re-up your income certification? And luckily, it was still very low. So we were able to consolidate and get that applied for. And now she's going to be 6 years of the way towards PSLF instead of only 2 years of the way towards PSLF because of the majority of her debt being from grad school. So this is the kind of transformational impact that we're having for clients right now. We typically save around $53,000 as projected client savings over the life of their loans from having a consult with us. In other words, the typical person that works with us gets about 100x return on their few hundred-dollar investment. But during the PSLF waiver, for people in the public service category at least, I would say that number is probably double. And that's because we're working with people with an average of $280,000 of student debt, but there's a huge barbell around that. So a teacher, we might save them $20,000, whereas a physician, we might save them $200,000, or a dentist, we might save them a ton of money. So, it is kind of an interesting situation right now because some people are like, we can do this on our own. Great. That's fine. If you want to self-provision, that's why we made some of these PSLF Facebook groups. That's why we give our stuff away on the newsletter for free. That's why we give our podcast away for free. We fully support people doing that. And I think that there's a whole another group of people out there that could do it on their own, but just wants that comfort to know that they're doing it all right. And then we get a lot of those people. And then there's probably an even bigger group of people out there that have no idea what they're doing and don't listen to podcasts like these and need our help and don't know it. So a couple quick notes about the pricing change September 1. So this is just something that we decided to just go ahead and try it, mainly because we want to be able to be accessible to people that do really need the help and want the help and are willing to pay for that help. And I'm expecting that with our existing team, we're going to get just totally slammed around that time. And so instead of having three different pricing levels, $395, $495, and $595, we're just going to one pricing level, $595 for all first-time clients and $495 for existing clients. And that's kind of what we're moving to September 1. So if you would benefit from getting a plan at that $395 rate before that pricing change goes up, go to studentloanplanner.com/book and you can sign up for any slot you want up to August 31st and lock in that existing pricing. So please do that to save yourself some money. I just wanted to make you all aware of that. A couple other things we're noticing right now. Department of Education is beginning to implement the IDR waiver in its early stages. So the reason we know this is we've seen a couple people's NSLDS files lately that have weird stuff in it. So what this means is they'll put in new codes for loans. They're putting in new stuff about the statutory interest rate, the actual interest rate, and the current interest rate. So they're adding extra data to NSLDS files, which is always interesting. But it broke a lot of our, at least these first initial changes for the NSLDS files, broke our spreadsheet, actually. And so I had to make a new version of the spreadsheet so that now that we can do the analysis we need to, if you've got the old NSLDS file or if you have the new one, our consultants are going to be able to handle either one. That's, again, I think why we haven't seen a ton of effective competition coming for us in the student loan advice market is this stuff just changes constantly. And so anybody that wants to go spend a bunch of money on tech, some app to pay down your student loans, you've got to be able to update that app almost constantly with all the new rules that come out. And we live and breathe this stuff. And at least I can program pretty good in VBA and Excel. And so far, that's done okay for us. So a couple other things with what's going on. So I don't know if you heard about it, but the Biden administration announced some big changes to interest capitalization and PSLF recently. Basically, I think it was last week or a couple weeks ago. And the proposal would take effect July 2023. This is pretty normal for new rules that are proposed. They tend to take effect for that new school year that starts, July 1st for federal student aid. And the proposal is that they're going to eliminate interest capitalization events in every situation where the Higher Education Act does not require it. That's pretty much just for people that are exiting IBR is when it requires capitalization, but every other time, apparently it doesn't. And so their proposal is to eliminate all interest capitalization what it sounds like it means to me is, you know, you borrow a bunch of debt for school. When you come out, you know, you might have $400,000 of loans from dental school and $100,000 of interest that you've accrued during school. So when you enter repayment, that $100,000 gets added to your $400,000, and now you have $500,000 that's generating interest on $500,000 instead of $400,000. And so this new proposal is going to make it so that you effectively always have simple interest instead of compounded interest. That's going to help people, particularly the people that are in and out of forbearance or delinquency a lot. So one of the reasons that people go into have huge amounts of debt is they will not know these interest capitalization rules exist. And if you, you know, call up your servicer, every time you go into a forbearance, it's going to capitalize your interest, which is the same thing as saying compound it. And so people will be in and out of forbearance, in and out of repayment, and then that'll be compounding their interest every single time. And if interest compounds at a 7 or 8% interest rate, then, you know, you're talking about the amount of debt doubling every 10 years. And if you have, you know, 8% plus some collection fees thrown in there, then it could maybe double every 5 or 7 years, right? So then you could get a situation where somebody, you know, you see these stories in the news, people say, I paid $50,000 of my $30,000 of loans, and how do I owe $90,000 still? It's because of these interest capitalization rules that have historically existed. And so this change is going to really help borrowers. In terms of forgiveness, it's kind of meaningless because if the debt's forgiven, I guess it might reduce your tax bomb a little bit. But in general, it's if you're going for forgiveness already, it doesn't matter at all, right? The amount of debt that you have forgiven virtually doesn't matter. Now, if you're going for refinancing and paying it back, this might change the calculus a little bit. And the reason is, let's say you have a 7% interest rate and you've got that $400,000 of debt and $100,000 of accrued interest. Well, in the past, that interest would be capitalized when you come out of school, and now you're paying 7% on $500,000. So that's $35,000 of interest expense. But if you're paying 7% on $400,000 when you come out of school, your actual interest rate is $28,000 of interest expense. So your effective rate would be $28,000 divided by 500 instead of $35,000 divided by 500. So it is different. What that kind of means is it's going to make refinancing slightly less attractive, not enormously less attractive, but slightly less attractive. And so what you might do is lean into things like the repay plan when you're a new graduate even more, and maybe try to pay down a little bit of your accrued interest to where it's maybe, I'm just picking an arbitrary number here, but when it's maybe about 10% of your principal balance, then you're probably getting enough interest rate savings to justify refinancing. I think most people won't take a very careful mathematical view of this. They will probably just refinance anyway, but it does have some interesting nuances for interest capitalization and that decision of when do you pull the trigger on refinancing. For the people who are paying down private loans or refinancing, listening to this podcast, there is something positive to be said about it from a psychological perspective. I had this conversation the other week. It's really kind of like, I'm not a great historian or anything, but isn't there like a story, I think, of Caesar crossing the Rubicon or something like that, and he burned all the bridges so that the people knew there was no turning back to make them more effective fighters? It's kind of like that when you refinance your student loans. When you do that, you can't undo it. You're stuck paying it back in full. And the downside of that is if you miss out on something like the PSLF waiver that comes out of left field that nobody was expecting. But the upside of that is you do lock in a fixed interest rate and a fixed payment, and you can know that you yourself will be paying down your student loan debt and getting yourself out of debt in full, hopefully far sooner than the 20-year type programs that currently exist for people paying down their student loans. The benefits of refinancing, I think, are in many ways psychological. If you think about why people like, you know, Dave Ramsey or Susie Orman have these huge followings, one reason is when you get somebody to really commit to paying down their debt, it's really helping them increase their savings rate. And when you increase your savings rate, that's money that doesn't get spent on that big trip to Disney World or the kitchen remodel or something. It's getting saved instead, and it's helping somebody be more frugal instead, and it's reducing their lifestyle needs for hitting things like financial independence and retirement. So I think a lot of reasons why the pay down debt advice is so popular is because it does work from a psychological perspective. Now, you could also take that same anti-debt approach and paying down your federal student loans to keep your options open too. Don't get me wrong. But I do think that there is something beneficial to saying, all right, we are very financially secure. We have our own occupation, disability, and term life insurance. We've got a nice house, so we know what our monthly payment is there. We're a two-income family, and we know what our big expenses are. We've got good health insurance. So we are going to take it upon ourselves to pay off our debt in 3 to 5 years instead of waiting around for 20 years with the Department of Ed. I think that there's a reasonable case to be made from doing that, not just mathematically, but also psychologically. the interest rates obviously have gone up quite a bit. Interest rates have sort of stabilized, at least in the near term. Obviously, that could change, but I do think that, you know, we're going to see a little bit better offers, you know, if you apply now than what if you'd applied about a month ago. We're also seeing this with mortgage interest rates. You know, mortgage rates were in the 6.25% range about a month ago, and now they're, I think, down in the like the low fives. So things have calmed down a little bit with fears of inflation, because what's going on in the economy is people are scared that the Fed's raising interest rates, which is going to send us into a recession, and a recession pulls interest rates down because people sort of get less scared about inflation and more scared about, you know, the dangers of the stock market falling from a recession. So that's kind of what we are dealing with right now. With IDR waiver stuff, I had some new thoughts about this. So if you're potentially one of these people that could benefit from the IDR waiver, meaning that you're in the private sector or you're part-time or even unemployed and you've had loans for a very long time, one of the things it says in the IDR account adjustment page is it says to benefit from the IDR waiver, if you have commercially held FFEL student loans, you must consolidate before we complete implementation of the IDR waiver, which is estimated to be no sooner than January 1st of 2023. So what that's telling you is you have to consolidate if you have commercially held FFEL loans, which is people from before 2010 that have it at some weird place like AES or Navient, for example. I would say it's probably fine to consolidate your loans if you have that kind of loan, because it says it on the page in Department of Ed that you have to consolidate to benefit. We're starting to update our advice to people that if you have commercially held FFEL loans and you're a good candidate for forgiveness anyway, that you might as well go ahead and consolidate now to get ahead of a little bit of the rush so that they'll start looking at updating your files. And like I said, we are seeing evidence of them updating the NSLDS files. I think it's a lot harder for them to do this than it is with the PSLF waiver, because they have to build in a tracking tool to track people's progress to forgiveness, and they don't even have that built out. Frankly, Department of Education has, I think it's fair to say, pissed off all of their student loan servicer partners, and you might say, good riddance, we don't care. And that's a reasonable view, because they certainly haven't done anything to warrant warm and fuzzy feelings about them. But I'm talking just from a practical borrower standpoint, when you update your partners about extensions at the last second and you give them no heads up at all, and you implement things like the PSLF waiver and the IDR waiver and give absolutely no playbook at all to the loan servicers to answer people's questions, the Department of Education people don't really care about the servicer people at all. And so if you're a leader over at the servicers trying to do a good job, you have nothing to go off of from the Department of Education. Which also what happens is when you inevitably do a bad job, because Department of Education doesn't think through a lot of these announcements before they make them, and they don't have that detailed operational plan written out before they make these plans public, then when inevitably the servicers screw up, and, you know, I'm not going to make any, I don't want to be defending servicers here. Like, obviously, there was forbearance steering. There was really bad implementation of PSLF. There was misinformation and is misinformation handed out constantly from these groups. But isn't that partly because Congress can't get its act together and simplify the student loan system, right? So, I mean, yes, it is partly the servicer's fault for sure, but Department of Education also needs to tell them what to say to people, and they're not doing that. What happened is you had all these servicers get lawsuits from different state attorneys general, which, you know, you could say maybe those are reasonable and legitimate complaints. The reaction is sort of like from FedLoan and Navient, which were frankly two of the ones that are community that had the worst ratings. So I do want to say that, right? Like, they did actually have the worst ratings of people's customer complaints with them, according to our data. But they just sort of threw their hands up and just said, okay, it's your problem. You deal with it. We're out, right? So Navient and FedLoan are out. And now it's Mohila and Nelnet closed down Great Lakes. Great Lakes actually had better customer service ratings in our community than Nelnet did. But why did they do that? It's because with so many extensions of the freeze, and also talking about doing 10,000 of student loan cancellation, that would actually cut Nelnet's revenue. I think it was like by a third, or cut it in half, because there's just way fewer borrowers to service. And that's not their job. That's not their right to complain about that, because policymakers are the ones who get to make those decisions. But what I'm saying is it's had a really interesting sort of adverse effect on the whole market, where Nelnet recently just had to lay off 150 customer service reps because, you know, they just didn't have anything to do, because people weren't calling, because they didn't have to make their loan payments after 3 years or 2 years. And they just had excess staff, and they had They were have a looming cancellation announcement they think might happen where they're going to get even less revenue. And their decision was, well, let's lay people off. And this, to me, feels a whole lot like the airline mess that we got ourselves into, where we had nobody traveling at all. And the airlines got some money, but not enough money to survive long term in this new normal of no air travel. And so they made this decision to lay all these people off. Then they found out with inflation and everything, they couldn't hire anybody back, or a lot of the people they couldn't hire back. And so then we have these cataclysmic staffing problems where you have all these massive amounts of cancellations at airports. And so I'm a little scared that that's going to be happening here with student loan payment restart. Is you've got, you know, Mohila, a completely inexperienced servicer, in my opinion. Nelnet, which closed down its more highly rated brand, Great Lakes, to consolidate everything at the parent company. They at least have some experience, right? And Mohila's taking over PSLF. Certainly, they don't have the experience even of Fed Loan in managing that. And then you've got Aidvantage, which another, again, is a brand new company. And in my opinion, I'm worried about them because they're sort of a subsidiary of this group that manages defaults for the Department of Education, and that hasn't gone super smoothly. So you've got this consolidation of servicers. Two of them are pretty green. And then you've got one servicer that does have experience that's, you know, sending a lot of their people home, and you know, when we might have a payment restart. And with the IDR waiver too, you know why they said, I think why they said January 1st, we're expecting to not complete implementation of this before January 1st of 2023. The reason I think that's the case is because the new Congress is sworn in January 2nd or January 3rd. And if the Democrats lose one of the houses of Congress, presumably Republicans would try to block the extension of the national emergency declaration from the Department of Health and just refuse to pass anything or, you know, agree to anyone getting appointed anywhere, which would be even more the case if the Republicans take the Senate, right? Because then they could block all the appointments too. And then they would have no choice but to end that national emergency declaration from Department of Health. And when that gets rescinded, all of their powers over student loans pretty much end, except for this negotiated rulemaking. But with that negotiated rulemaking, there's limits to what they can do. You know, they can give credit for certain kinds of deferment or forbearance, limit interest capitalization, make a new income-based repayment plan. So they'll still have a lot of power, but nothing nearly like what they have right now, which is basically saying, hey, let's back the truck up, apply for forgiveness, we're going to hand it out like candy. I wish people were more aware of that, because a lot of people are skeptical about consolidating. I had a great comment from one of our Facebook groups this week that was like, hey, like, I trust you, but like, I'm a trust but verify kind of person. Can you post an example of something that says if I consolidate, I'm not going to lose all my credit and all my payments for PSLF? That's preventing a lot of people from taking action. Having a complicated bureaucratic process for consolidating is preventing people from taking action. Another thing is, one of the things we watch out for is, we tell people consolidate first, wait for the consolidation to be completed, and then apply. And the reason for that is, if you apply, if you have one $3,000 loan that's a FFELP loan owned by Department of Ed that's 10 years old and the rest of your stuff's 3 years old, if you apply first for the ECF form for PSLF, they'll forgive that one loan, the $3,000 loan, and the rest of your stuff will not be able to get that additional credit. You could have had the whole thing forgiven. There's a $200,000 mistake that people tried to save a few hundred dollars to do it on their own, right? I don't say that in a mean way, but I'm just saying, like, that's the danger that you should be aware of, right? Is if you're not super familiar with these rules, it's real easy to make a six-figure mistake. Given the restrictions of the PSLF waiver and just the complicated aspects to it, a lot of people, when you see complicated stuff, you just freeze and don't do anything. For example, we were looking for a L-shaped desk for our guest bedroom so my wife could work at that desk. And I guess, like, there was a cool one that had a great design, and we bought it, and then we opened it up, and it's like worse than IKEA. It's like, there's like 27 steps to put together this desk. It took me 4.5 hours. And if I had known that it was going to do that, I never would have tried to do it on my own. It was sort of like after the fact, when we already had it delivered, that I realized, like, oh my gosh, this thing is terrible. And looking at those 27 steps, I was paralyzed. I was just like, oh my gosh, like, am I ever going to be able to do this? You know, and I just decided, like, I just had to power through it no matter what. And I got through it, but it was miserable. And I can make other analogies. The other problem is when you get help, it better be good help. It better be the best. This is probably way too much information, but, like, we had this problem with, like, rodents that got into our like wall somehow. Like we think it's like they came in through the chimney or something. And we went through one pest control group and they did some stuff, right? But like weren't super deep experts. And then the problem wasn't fixed and it got worse. And then we looked for like the highest rated pest control, the people that really knew what they were doing, and we hired them and they seemingly have fixed it. So I like to think that we are the best at fixing whatever student loan problems that you have. I don't know, maybe freaked a couple of you out talking about stuff like that, but I think it's like, it's interesting and instructive to make comparisons, right, to this stuff and other things in your life. We want people to get forgiveness. We want people to get as much forgiveness as they're entitled to. We want people to not have to stress about this and to be able to be relaxed when they're making, you know, these big decisions and not feel anxiety about things. And so these free PSLF Facebook groups are going to help a lot. So definitely check those out. Just remember Facebook, you can type in occupation and PSLF and you'll find it. And then obviously hiring our consultants before this price change, September 1, studentloanplanner.com/book. That's pretty much all that I've got for you folks this week. If you have any feedback or questions, hit us up, help@studentloanplanner.com. Also, feel free to leave a question, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, if you'd like to ask a question that we can feature on the next episode that we do. And I imagine that we will have announcements of whatever the new income-based repayment plan might be sometime in July, and we'll probably find out about the final payment and interest pause. We're still anticipating it's going to be December 31st, probably to line up with the expiration of the IDR waiver and the PSLF waiver. So my guess is they'll say, you know, to try to really convince people that payments are actually starting after like so many extensions, they'll probably say something like, all right, you know, we need one final extension to implement all these changes. We're going to make the new IBR plan available with early entry, so December 31st, and we're going to cancel 10,000 of student debt. And the question is do we get that held up in litigation? My thought is that it might get held up in litigation because guess what? This is another separate thing, but borrower defense to repayment, all these schools that got listed on this like presumptive defrauded your students list, they can't afford to have their school names on this list. That's terrible for them to try to market your school. And by the way, Department of Ed is saying, hey, if you attended this school, that's proof enough that your loans should be forgiven because of presumptive proof that you've been defrauded. What I think is going to happen there, like a lot of people are asking us, like from Ross, for example, Ross University Med and Vet School, a lot of people are asking, hey, should I apply for this? Well, first off, there's this thing that the Trump administration put in for borrower defense where the schools can withhold your transcript in some cases if you apply. So you got to figure out, is that important or not? And then the second thing is, this is a proposal, right? Sweet v. Cardona. I just thought I'd just talk about this at the end of today's podcast. I just thought about it. Sweet v. Cardona is like this, basically the Harvard Project against predatory student lending versus Cardona, Secretary of Education for President Biden. This is a collaborative lawsuit, I think. Like this is not like a adversarial type of thing where there's two different groups with different interests going at it. Like these are like people that are like a core part of the Democratic coalition that's working with the administration to figure out how do we get needed relief to borrowers fast. And so this sort of settlement, what they did is I think if they had more than a certain number of complaints, I think in some cases only like three or four, they would put the school's name on this list. So it had to be, it's almost all for-profit schools. And then it's like, do you have at least three borrower complaints for borrower defense? And if yes, they just put a ton of the school names on this list. And this borrower defense settlement's getting put in front of a Clinton-appointed judge. And, you know, I think it's reasonable to guess that they might approve the settlement. And so if you're a school like Ross or Kerr Institute or some of these other groups that are on this list, the trade group for this group of schools, the proprietary schools, has already said this is like super unfair and it's arbitrary. And you can tell, I think, they're already preparing, you know, a lawsuit over this. And so what you'd probably do if you were them is wait for this settlement to come out and then do like an emergency stay or something like that in a different court that's more friendly to you, and then just keep appealing. So that's my guess is, you know, you're going to see all this borrower defense stuff get held up in litigation, which maybe they go after the emergency authority over student loans during the pandemic. Who the heck knows at this point? But I will say this, all these waiver programs are real. People are getting real relief. If you look historically, the Republican Party doesn't like to claw back things that have already been handed out to people from a contracts perspective. Like if you look at when they proposed eliminating PSLF, they basically said only for people that are new borrowers, right? If you look at the Prosper Act, which they proposed in 2017, and that was going to make one really bad IBR plan, they said only for new borrowers. So my guess with all these waiver programs is people that apply for them are going to get them. And then maybe you see some sort of lawsuit that stops it if there's a group that's sufficiently angry to spend a bunch of money on lawyers to sue over it. And with this new borrower defense thing, I would not be too surprised if we see some big lawsuits from this for the for-profit schools that are fighting to survive. So hope you're having a good summer. Hope you're having fun. Hope you're, again, listening to this, working out in the gym and or you know, going on a nice run or nice long drive or something. Thank you for allowing me to share these updates with you. Hopefully it's fun. Hopefully it's kind of entertaining. Apologize for any weird analogies that I do. You know, just trying to make it relatable. And would love feedback to the show. Hit us up. I'm Travis, a student loan planner. Thanks so much for listening.